future of casual space travel and perfectly blending androids can seem so foreign and far away, but there are some less anxiety-inducing technologies that have changed our lives for the better already, like fresh roasted coffee delivered right to your door. Coffee lovers know that the secret to making the best cup of coffee is starting with freshly roasted beans, but getting your hands on fresh roasted coffee can be easier said than done. Or at least it was until Sparkplug Coffee came to the rescue. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-calf. But best of all, they deliver this excellent coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So, plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, you movie lovers from many light years away, and thanks to the ends of the universe for downloading the next 100 project. Our AFI quest is over. Now we explore strange worlds, i.e. random flicks from here, there, and everywhere. Warning off the schneid, we are spoiling fools. My name is Ryan Ellis, last survivor of the Nostromo, other than a kick-ass woman and her stupid cat. And my partner in these podcast ventures is my delightful wife, Mother. I mean,
that's me.
Mother! You bitch! Ripley calls a, well, not villain, I guess, in this movie, but two characters at the end of each of the first two movies, a bitch. Of course, get away from her, you bitch, in Aliens, and then she calls the computer a bitch in this movie. So, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Alien. What is the order in which the various characters die in Alien, meaning who goes first, then second, and so on?
So, first is the easy one, which is Kane, their executive officer, John Hurt, who's the one that gets the alien burst out of his stomach. Mm-hmm.
He's also the first one to wake up when they all come out of cryosleep.
Oh, how about that?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And then the second is Brett, Harry Dean Stanton, who gets bit in the massive, mysteriously empty space in the ship. Number three is Dallas, Tom Skerritt, who goes looking forward to attack it and gets got. The next two I had to look up because I couldn't remember who died first, but... Mm. Oh, no, sorry. Ash goes next, the android. Great. Not sure if he counted or not, but it is a great death.
And a great twist. No one knows he's an android until you find out he is an android.
And there's the next two that I struggled with because it's Parker and then Lambert, but I couldn't remember who died first.
Parker does.
Lambert is the last one to die. There's a point in the film where there's no white men left. They get left with two women and a black dude. If I was watching this for the first time and I didn't know what was going to happen, this would just leave me so adrift of who's the hero going to be because you're so used to the hero being the Tom Skerritt. But after Tom Skerritt dies... It's anybody's guess.
And he's the middle.
Or maybe nobody will survive.
And he's in the middle of all the people that do die. Yeah, Parker gets killed and then Lambert. They're right back to back, but she does live a little bit longer than him. I think she dies of fright.
You just hear her scream. You don't really know exactly what happens to her, but she's a goner.
It's the touch from The Night of the Living Dead where you've got the black guy who's the last survivor of the ones we care about anyway, and a woman. They last longer than everybody else. And that was unusual in 1968. 11 years later, it's also unusual. And people probably don't really pick up on the fact, okay, Ripley, yeah, the woman... who lives to the end, but then that became a horror cliche around this time. Halloween maybe didn't start that trend, but you could argue made it famous, where the virginal girl is the last one to live, although most of the people that die in the movie are girls. But anyway, the point is that the woman is at the end, but it's also a woman who's second last, and a black guy is third last.
Yeah.
And if you really want to count the alien in there, then it's two black guys.
Oh, because it was a black dude that played the alien in the suit.
No, I just mean
although,
that,
don't we learn that that's a female? Oh, because we don't know an alien.
No, I just mean the alien is black.
Oh, I see, okay.
Okay, the next 100 Project 60-second movie, Alien, was unsuccessfully nominated for both AFI Top 100s, and as we said last week, I'm a bit surprised. I thought maybe it would make it certainly the second time, maybe even should have the first time.
Yeah, I can't believe Alien isn't on either of the AFI's lists.
It was released by 20th Century Fox on June 22nd, 1979. The sci-fi horror hybrid made a killing. How appropriate. Okay, Bev, this film is pretty famous, but explain it for those who don't know what it's about with Skinny.
In the year 2122, Sigourney Weaver is Ripley, a member of the crew of Nostromo, a mining spaceship returning to Earth with its payload when it's waylaid by a mysterious distress signal. While investigating, a hostile alien finds a very creative way to hitch a ride on their ship and begins killing the crew one at a time.
Or in a nutshell, grumpy miners on a far-flung mission die while following orders. Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers on this movie, 97% of critics like it, 99 fresh, 3 rotten, and 94% of audiences. More proof this movie should have been on the AFI's Top 100. The sequels, by the way, on the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, Aliens has 98%, so just a little bit more than Alien. Alien 3, or Alien Cubed, has only 44% of critics on its side. And Alien Resurrection, the fourth one, is actually higher than Alien 3. It's got 54% of people on its side. So they obviously go down in quality, but Alien and Aliens, and as you said last week, Aliens is a movie that also could have been strongly considered for the main list, but it wasn't even nominated, I don't think, either time. So
that's surprising.
Wasn't going to make it. And Alien was sixth at the 1979 U.S. box office. Kramer vs. Kramer, the best picture winner that year, was number one, and Apocalypse Now that we covered and I love, and I think Bev does too, was number four. All right, so the movie that no studio wanted to make at first because it was too bloody, although Roger Corman did, the independent producer.
Yeah.
He was interested in making this picture, but of course it eventually went to Fox. What did you think about it?
Oh, I love this movie. I think it's nearly perfect. This is not a genre that I typically am fond of, but when a movie is just this tight and well-written and well-directed, how can you resist it? It's great.
Well, we just talked about Aliens. Do you prefer this or the second one?
I prefer Alien. I prefer this. I'm definitely, like, a more Ridley Scott than James Cameron kind of person. Not that Ridley Scott is my favorite. Far from it. I actually have my fair share of problems with him as a filmmaker, but, no, Alien is definitely my favorite.
Like this, Thelma and Louise, for that matter. You're a big fan of that one.
I love Thelma and Louise, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You could call this movie Kafka's Very Fast Metamorphosis. It does change its size and shape and talents very fast.
It changes its size unrealistically fast because, like any creature, it's just a rule of biology. You can't get bigger without eating. It would need to take in calories in order to grow. You could argue it could grow that quickly, but it couldn't grow that big without consuming a human-sized amount of calories.
And it doesn't eat any humans until
it's already big.
Well, it's not really eating anyway. In fact, a very important deleted scene. I get why they took it out because it does ruin the pace. After Ripley hears Lambert and Parker die over the intercom and she knows she's the only one left, she has to get to the ship and get out of there. Of course, she has the cat, and that's dumb. She'd leave the fucking cat behind, but anyway.
No, you saved the cat. More on that later.
But she comes across the cocooned bodies of Brett and Dallas. Brett is long gone. Dallas is just enough alive to say, "Kill me." And that's reprised in Aliens, very smartly by James Cameron, where the person is still somehow alive. And it's funny, too, because Kane was very much alive. They didn't even know anything was wrong with him. Neither did he, until it decided to come out of his chest. I think this is an important scene to show Brett being cocooned. And it plays into the sequels, of course, because that becomes a big part of all the future movies where that's what the alien is doing. So we say eating, getting back to that point. It wasn't eating
Brett. For the record, though, Ridley Scott disagreed with you because those scenes got cut. We didn't see that.
Yeah, but we know they exist and we know that's where the sequels went. So unfortunately, we're affected by that. Future knowledge.
I don't miss it. It's almost more like a fun reveal in Aliens. Aliens gets to include that detail and further the canon a little more than Alien. I don't think Alien needs it.
Well, it does help that Ripley is just absolutely devoted to getting to that escape pod and getting the hell out of there.
With Jonesy.
And of course. And you also see at one point movement in the pod when they show it before she's gotten there. She is off somewhere else. And I think that's the movie suggesting that it's the alien going in there. It somehow knows she's going there, and it's either following her, or it's smarter than she thinks it is, or even smarter than her, and it's already hiding away.
I find when they're running around the ship, which I love the design of the ship, but it's spatially confusing. So okay. Even if I saw it going in somewhere, I wouldn't necessarily put it together that it was the escape hatch.
Okay. All right, well, back to the film as a whole. It's set in 2122, so we have 105 years to make space travel dull and tiresome and to bitch and bitch and bitch the whole time.
We have 100 years to make it blue collar. It's almost like they're on a freighter ship.
Just a boring old day, mining in space. The movie does take its time to show any horror, and it takes its time to really get anywhere either, for that matter. And one thing I timed in this viewing we had is just how long they're on that planet with the derelict ship. It's about a half an hour of the movie that they first land and before they leave.
I think it's one of the biggest strengths of the film that has this really slow burn to start. You really slowly get to know the characters. They land on the planet and they have a good chance to give you the exposition of their situation, that they're minors, that they stand to lose a lot of money, that they're obligated to investigate this and nobody's interested in it. They just do it because they have to. There's that long landing sequence, which kind of sets up this idea of peril and that the work they do is hard and that it's dangerous. And where they are in that moment is dangerous, too. The introduction of the ship, it's amazing, almost more so because they go in the ship and there's this enormous set and then they leave it and never come back. But it leaves this huge, mysterious impression of where did it come from? And is that pilot with the chest burst open?
The space jockey.
Like, how long has he been there? Yeah, the space jockey. How long has he been there? How did he die? Is he one of the aliens or is he one of the victims?
Why did the alien get in his chest in the first place? Or its chest in the first place?
Who knows?
Because it looks like it's had an exploded alien. And we don't know at that point in the movie that that's happened. And they certainly don't know why that's happened. But knowing the way this storyline goes...
And they never answer those questions because they wouldn't know the answers to those questions. There's not a lot of extra detail in this film. Like, they don't really focus on details that aren't important to the plot. You don't learn a lot about the backstories of the character. Thankfully, there's no scene where they all sit around and they're sweating and they're worried and they talk about people back home or the reasons why they wanted to work in space and escape the place they came from or some sappy backstories. I didn't miss it. It's not necessary. And I think it's cooler that we never learned the origin or the history of that ship that they're on. All that stuff takes so much time. It's so interesting. It's so creepy. Then there's like the action with the face hugger. And yet still they slow it down again after he's been brought back on the ship and he's in the hospital and they're trying to determine the health room.
Sick bay,
thank you. And they're trying to determine what to do with him.
Freeze him.
Of course they can't because then it would be the end of the movie. But
Parker's right, though. He says we should just freeze him.
And Ripley's right when she's like, don't let him in the ship at all.
Right. And the funny thing, too, is that Ash, as the science officer who is part of the whole conspiracy to make sure that any of these things happen, should probably agree with that. He probably should recommend that to Dallas. Freeze him so then you make sure you get the alien back there.
I know. It really does make a lot of sense. When you know what's going to happen, where it's going, and what Ash's real motivations are, you're still like, you really should just freeze it.
And also, it's said by Ripley that Mother deciphers the signal they get as a warning. But is it an SOS or is it a warning?
We don't know.
Is their entire mission... Yeah, they're going out there to get ore. But is the entire mission just a front to send them out there to go get an alien sample?
No, because you think if that was the case, then they would send out a specialized crew.
Like they do in the second movie.
Well, exactly. We learn in the second movie, which granted is 57 years later, so the company could have changed dramatically since then, but we learn that they have these militia-style employees that would be specially trained just to handle situations like this, rather than putting it in the hands of a science officer, a warrant officer, a miner.
But the storyline in the second movie is also to bring back some samples. It isn't about necessarily just destroying the planet.
No, but it's about just bringing back samples of the aliens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you send the best military...
Rather than samples of ore.
But if you send the best military guys out there, then logically they should win, although maybe the company knew they weren't going to win. They were overmatched against these aliens. You talked about the spaceship a minute ago. You meant the derelict ship that's crashed. I thought you were talking about their spaceship, and when we see that in the very beginning, it's a similar opening to Star Wars. You get the establishing shot. It's the same studio. It's 2 years later. 20th Century Fox did both movies. And, of course, Star Wars was homaging 2001 with its long spaceship shot. Not the beginning of the movie, of course, because that's well into 2001 before you see that long seaman-looking shot of the spaceship, or the seaman-looking design of the spaceship, I should say.
And the interior of the spaceship was inspired by Star Wars as well, because Star Wars was one of the first sci-fi films to really get dirty and make things look used and lived in, and they definitely copy that here to great effect, too. I think it makes the film way better to give it authenticity.
And the whole movie has some of the creepiest props and sets ever shown on film, because this is a haunted house in space.
Yeah, it's like a 10 Little Indians plot.
Mm.
It ultimately becomes a slasher film.
Halloween, I said, the year before this, a giant hit in its own right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of similarities.
Or the Night of the Living Dead, too, which you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. It's very much a horror film, also a sci-fi film. It's harder to pigeonhole what exactly it is. I guess the first thing you'd say about it is it's sci-fi, but I think you could also very easily just call it plain horror. But then we talked about Jaws when we did that podcast. Is it horror? Is it action-adventure? Is it a thriller? By the way, both movies, the villain is very rarely in both of them. The Alien, I'd forgotten this until I was reading this online and then paid attention more in this viewing to the specific amount of time it is on screen. And it's only about 4 minutes in total that the Alien is on screen in any form.
What's the Hitchcock line? When a bomb goes off, that's action. But when a bomb is in a room waiting to explode, that's...
tension.
Tension.
That's suspense.
That's suspense. Thank you. Yeah. And that's Alien. You know the Alien's in there. But Hitchcock goes on to say, you enjoy the suspense more than you enjoy the action. So you enjoy this edge of your seat paranoia of who's going to get killed next and who's in danger, and you genuinely don't know what's going to happen. I mean, nobody goes into this film, even if they've never seen it, without knowing that Ripley, of course, survives. She's just such an iconic character now. She's been in all the sequels. Okay, fine, you know that she's going to be okay, but it doesn't matter. When you are just on the razor's edge, wondering what's going to happen next, that's the fun of it. And it's worse if you see the alien. The more mysterious the alien is, the better the suspense
looks,
as well.
Looks like a guy in a suit otherwise, if you see him too often.
Yeah.
Or it too often. And did I see you jump a little bit when it kills Captain Dallas?
You did indeed. I'm not sorry. I'm not embarrassed.
And all it is the guy in the suit, Balaji Badejo, throws its arms out and there's a shriek sound effect cut to black. Maybe not black, but cut away from that scene. And we know that Dallas is dead.
Well, you cut to the reaction of everybody in the ship who can hear what's happening. And their sickening panic reaction to learning the captain is likely
dead. And then all bets are off because they killed off the captain third.
Yeah. It reminds me of, and of course this was surely inspired by Aliens, but Deep Blue Sea, which famously kills off a character.
Sam Jackson,
I don't want to totally spoil it.
Oh, everyone's
but, I mean, everyone knows
seen
this,
that,
right?
For crying out
Not
loud.
Only do they kill Sam Jackson in the middle of the film, but they kill him after he's just given a big inspiring
We're
speech.
We're not going to fight anymore. We're going to band together. Rawr! I literally jumped. That got me. It was a great moment in that movie. That's not a very good movie, but that's a hell of a great
moment.
But
it's a great movie. It's like one of the best B films.
I very much enjoy it, but it is bad. But that is one of the great moments in any film. All right, so let's go back to the planet where they're investigating the derelict ship. They're wearing spacesuits, and they nearly killed the actors because they didn't have it properly ventilated. They weren't really breathing air properly. And then when you see the air coming out of it, as if it's supposed to be the CO2 coming out of their suit, that was just some other kind of aerosol or something or other. And that somehow got reversed, and I guess either Tom Skerritt or Veronica Cartwright or John Hurt were nearly poisoned by that shit.
And then they still didn't fix it until there's a scene when they're in the derelict ship, you call it, where they're in front of the space jockey. They wanted it to look bigger, so they put children in the suits so that they would be smaller and everything would look bigger by comparison. And when those kids, of course, the kids were Ridley Scott's kid and one of the producers, I think.
Or cinematographer.
And the kids got really sick. And then they finally were like, okay, maybe we've crossed the line. Yeah. Maybe we should give some ventilation to our poor, suffering actors.
And that idea of using small people for perspective was also done in Casablanca, where they used the little people to make the plane look like it was bigger in the last scene in Casablanca. When Kane goes down into the nest of all the eggs, and it's one of those moments where you know what's coming if you've seen the movie before, if you know anything about this film, so it's one of those, get the hell out of there, but of course he has to go down, or else there'd be no ending, no movie period. You see blue lasers, and that was something they borrowed from The Who. That's a nice touch. It even has an audio effect that you can hear that little buzzing kind of sound when Kane crosses it, and you wonder, is that supposed to be alerting the eggs to say, oh, something's here? Yeah. And how long was that ship there, too? Is it supposed to be hundreds of years? Prometheus was supposed to answer that. I'm not a hater of that movie. I only ever saw it once. I wanted to see it again. I probably should have saw it before this. The one thing I'll say, and then we'll move on from Prometheus, is that they set up a lot of what is in the derelict ship, where everything is spatially. And then he ruins it and has things move around after it looks like it's in place. But anyway, that's Prometheus. And well, we're doing this podcast because they're doing Alien Covenant later this week.
Mm-hmm.
And that should set up more for this movie, which is a very sexual film. There's insertion and extraction everywhere. They call some of the stuff vagina dentata. I guess the original Alien design was way more sexual than it already is, which is saying something.
Well, have you ever seen the original Giger painting that inspired the whole look? It's very similar to what ends up in the movie, except for some aspects that surely would have just been impossible to put in costume. The head's much longer. It's always phallic, but it's way, way longer in the original painting.
It's a very tactile movie, too. Not every movie do you feel like you can touch it or you can understand what they're touching.
And the actors do a great job of looking really natural in that ship, like they are just people doing their workaday jobs.
Okay, but getting back to the whole sexuality of the movie, when Kane is attacked by the alien, that's a form of male rape. And what we see is a man gets a chance to feel what it's like to be pregnant. Of course, it's a lot different, but similar in some ways. And then to give birth. What a violent, awful way that he does give birth. You could argue the alien should have come out of his penis, but that would have been way worse.
And it is, in a way, right? Because this is how the alien procreates. Mm. So he was, for all intents and purposes, raped by the alien and knocked up in the process.
And you can't really blame the alien for just doing what it does.
And then there's that additional thing, and if you really think about it, plenty of women, when they're raped, could get pregnant, and then there's that additional trauma of wondering what kind of baby you're going to have.
And Ash even says, Kane's baby, about the alien at one point. Hmm. And then Ash uses a magazine to orally rape Ripley. Ridley Scott talks about that in the commentary, because you remember that moment where he sticks the magazine in your mouth. Why is that? Okay, you could argue he's just trying to strangle her, which is a strange way to strangle her. He could simply overpower her, you would think, because he's a robot. But Ridley Scott's logic on that one is that he wants to know what it feels like to have sex, but he doesn't have sex organs, at least not working ones, so this is his version of doing it.
Ash is such a curious character because he certainly has an inner life. We see the machinations of what's going on in his brain. We see these private moments and expressions that he has where he looks like he's experiencing doubt, or he's clearly deceiving somebody or questioning something somebody says. These types of things that you would think would be programmed out of a robot. Part of that is the red herring or hiding the twist that he is a robot, and we as the audience are not supposed to know until 2/3 of the way through the film when the big reveal happens. But there seems to be quite a few reaction shots that, when you go back and watch it for the second time knowing, then you're invited to think this android truly has free will. Like, he really is a person in there, in a manner of speaking.
Well, just like in 2001, where the AI has been programmed to not tell the humans what it knows.
But Hal is a total robot. There's no mistaking Hal for human, and even though we kind of know Hal has artificial intelligence and a personality in there, it doesn't have the flaws that a human has the way that Ash does.
What I mean, though, is that maybe part of the problem with Ash and Hal, both, is that they want to be fully honest, because why would a computer ever lie? Why would a robot in either version lie? But they are programmed to not tell the truth. So there's also little details in there that are pointed out in this little book I have, really great analysis of the movie. When Ash gets up at one point and then Parker goes to sit down, he wipes the seat as if there's some kind of residue left over by this robot. Also, we see Ash drinking milk, and then later on, when he's bashed in the face, he's spewing milk everywhere, so I guess that's its version of sustenance. Mm-hmm. Maybe none of the rest of them really picked up on what he's actually eating or not eating, because he doesn't need to eat normal food, you wouldn't think. Maybe they program it so he can, but anyway. The other point about the Ash character, that actually Ridley Scott points it out in the commentary, when they go down to the planet to eventually get the alien, Ash does this little running thing, like he has to loosen up.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Those little moments. These very human moments.
And Ridley Scott speculates that maybe the robot gets stiff.
Okay, yeah, maybe. Mm-hmm.
Now, when they bring Kane back, and you mentioned Ripley tries to quarantine him, which is absolutely protocol, Dallas and Lambert are the emotional ones, the captain being one of those two, ironically, and Ripley is the very together person. If she'd got her way, again, there's no movie, because Kane would never have been allowed into the ship. He would have got back to wherever it would be, whether it be Earth itself or some kind of spaceport outside of Earth, and then all hell would have broke loose.
Yeah, it's so much worse if they actually succeeded in their mission to bring the alien home.
But Ripley is always following the proper orders. They don't listen to her, and that's what goes wrong. They also don't listen to Lambert very well. She's the one that says to both Kane and Dallas more than once when they're on the planet, let's get out of here, let's go. And they don't listen to her, and then, of course, bad things happen. And she's the one that's saying, to hell with the mission, let's just get out of here and save ourselves. And they don't do it soon
enough. They care about the money, too. Mm-hmm. If they give up on the mission, then they all go home.
And they're following orders from their company, like most people do in regular life.
I love the part that Ripley is the one who's like, leave him out there. This is protocol. You have to quarantine him. And they don't listen to her, and it really sets it up for Tom Skerritt to be the hero again, and for her to kind of be the antagonist. You don't know in this movie who the hero is until the very end, and what makes her a hero is the way that she can just get stuff done, and she doesn't let emotions get in the way. Those are the qualities in her that make her win and survive.
Well, speaking of survival, the alien's a great survivor because, for one thing, it's got acid for blood. And as Parker even says, you don't dare kill it. That's a great conceit, of course. You can't just go ahead and... Well, they don't really have those kinds of weapons like they do in Aliens to go ahead and blast at it. And in one scene in Aliens, when a guy uses a machine gun to shoot away at it, its blood comes flying at him and burns him and kills him. And also that happens to Michael Biehn's character. He gets hit by the alien's blood, and then he's not dead, but he's incapacitated. So that's why Ripley has to be the hero at the end of Aliens without him. And also, who knew chasing an acid drip could be so exciting as they go through the entire ship? And it just stops. I guess the idea is that it Well, did it control itself somehow? Or maybe it just went far enough and it diluted itself.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think there's just only so much damage acid can do. And so it, like, reached that limit. But what a great idea. Because, you know, if it reaches a certain point, they have no way of stopping it. It'll breach the ship and then they're fucked.
Actually, there's a way of stopping it. Just get a glass beaker and catch it as it comes through.
Glass impervious to acid? I guess so.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess when you're chasing a... acid drop from flight to flight, you just don't necessarily know where your glass speakers are kept handy.
Didn't know the acid was coming out. That was like they were
warning. Yeah, exactly.
All right, so how about the chest bursting scene? They got that in one take, and the reactions were real. Veronica Cartwright's talked about this a lot when she was sprayed with blood in the face, and you hear, oh, God! She went flying over something, head over heels, and you see these cowboy boots sticking up in the air. You don't see it in the movie, but she says that's what happened to her. And that moment is still one of the greats in the history of movies, even when you know it's coming.
The performances are amazing. I mean, the special effects are great. I definitely don't want to undersell how good they made it look, how amazing the design of that particular stage of the alien's life is. But John Hurt's face, his reaction to the pain and the sudden trauma that's happening to him, everybody's reaction, it sells that scene 100%.
And then when he's lying there dead, I like how his hands are just kind of flipping around and that spasm thing you have when you're dying. People who know this movie have probably heard the story about how he's got his body through the table, so all you really see is his head, his shoulders, and his arms. The rest of it is just a fake body, and he was laying there for a long, long time. And that's his last scene. He's so memorable in the film. He wasn't even in the film originally. It was John Finch, another English actor, and then John Hurt got the role last minute when Finch, I think, got sick. Michael Biehn had the same thing happen to him. They cast James Remar in his role in Aliens, and then I don't know what it was, but James Cameron fired Remar. And Biehn came on from one weekend to the next. He'd been the star of the previous movie that Cameron made, The Terminator. They already started shooting. They already had a camaraderie and everything. And then he just became part of the cast with no prep time. So two major characters in both movies got the role at the last minute and then aced it.
Ridley Scott said he cast total pros and just chose them for their talent. And he said that he did that on purpose because he wanted them to be able to do the work and for them to be people he could trust to really own the characters, because he wanted to focus on what was happening visually and all the special effects.
I like that they all do seem so tired, and they've been on cryosleep. They probably shouldn't be so tired and exhausted, but I guess they just are tired and exhausted people in general, maybe. The original idea was to have more casual fornicating and people would be naked, but it wouldn't be that it's a big deal. It's not like it's some porno movie. It's just that, well, we fuck because we fuck. So
because
what?
You're out in space for what I presume to be years at a time.
What happens in the Nostromo stays in the Nostromo. And Tom Skerritt was the main star of the film in the opening credits, and would have thought he'd be the big star because he was the biggest one, I would say. He was in MASH in 1970, which we covered. Harrison Ford almost had the role, but Skerritt's the right casting because he isn't as big a star as Ford was becoming after the first Star Wars film. Skerritt was a big enough name, though, that you think, well, there's no way he's going to die, and he is the one you probably would attach to. On the flip side, Sigourney Weaver was an unknown. She had that tiny role at the end of Annie Hall, which no one even knew she was in until they heard about that later. And then she went on to make so many great movies, Ghostbusters and Avatar. Well, not a great movie, but anyway, she's in it. And all three of the Alien sequels so far that she's been in. I don't know if she's going to be in Covenant. Well, that's also a prequel. But anyway, so what do you think of her and her star-making performance?
I did a lot of research about just the character of Ripley and what makes her so iconic. And a lot of people say the same thing, which is, Sigourney Weaver's a smart woman, and she plays Ripley as a smart character, and that's what sets her apart and makes her special. Originally, all the characters were written to be sexless, like they could fill in a man or a woman in any characters, so easily you could take any of those lines and any of those actions she does and replace it with a dude, and it would be the same, except it never would be the same, because it is really special and radical that she's a smart, competent woman who's not there to titillate and not there to be a damsel in distress. Sigourney Weaver's presence makes it. Her intelligence makes it. It's very convincing that she would be this no-nonsense badass.
But then they do get her down to her skivvies at the end of the film, too.
Oh, yeah. They had to throw that in. I remember the first time I watched the movie, like, just rolling my eyes. Man, you got this far.
But it made logical sense, though, too, because she thinks she's going to cryosleep within minutes, so why wouldn't she get down to her underwear?
In space, no one can cover their butt crack. Because those skivvies are so little. They're the most impractical underwear when every other item of clothing they're wearing is perfectly practical. And then she's wearing these impossibly small panties.
Let's get back again to the scene where Ash dies. Because the most famous death, of course, is Kane's. But when Ash, well, dies is the wrong word, I guess, because he's a robot. I always thought this was so badly done. I never understood why they didn't do a quick little cover shot with one of the other actors looking at Ash's beaten corpse. Because they're trying to fix the head, and then they cut, and they've got, again, a guy going through, in this case, not a table, but through a floor, I guess. Ian Holm's last scene in the film. He sounds like his voice is all messed up. He's very cocky. I like that too. It's a nice touch. Even though he's a robot, he's almost mean-spirited. HAL 9000 isn't really mean-spirited in 2001.
But Ash has human flaws, and he's like, well, now that you know who I am, I may as well be a smug asshole about it. I'm going to use my last moments on Earth, last moments alive, to just be a snarky dick.
But when they cut to him replacing the prop head, there's this bad continuity, and I've always picked up on that. I think it's so awful that they do it that way. They could have had a little cover shot in there, and it would have worked out well, because it would have seemed so cool to make it look like Ian Holm was bashed for real, and then suddenly you reveal, oh my god, it's a special effect, which you know it is, but now you really know it is.
And it really seems like it would be a super easy fix. But my only explanation I can think of is that they simply didn't get the coverage when they were there on the day.
Because there is the director's cut that does show Dallas and Brett being cocooned. So they could have fixed that back then. They didn't do it. All right, so the end of Alien, and the end of Aliens also has this, a ticking clock. The line, you bitch, in both movies. Ripley has a flamethrower at the end of this movie, but a grenade launcher in the sequel. I like how she advances there. And then the fake-out ending in Alien. One more scare because the alien's still in the cockpit. It's said more than once in the film that if they ever get hold of the alien in some kind of way, don't try to be a hero, we're just going to blast it out into space. Well, ta-da! That's what Ripley does. She blasts it out into space.
What exactly was the corporation planning to do with this alien if they got their hands on it? I guess it's possible they simply didn't know what they were getting their hands on when they sent the crew to investigate. But I can't imagine how this alien could be useful to anybody.
I think it's a lack of foresight on the part of the company. But let's just put it into modern terms. Let's say an alien was around now and the American government got a hold of that and wanted to throw it into the Middle East, wherever ISIS is right now. We just saw Vice that talked about how the Taliban in Afghanistan is worse than it ever was. Well, I think that's the logic from the company, because it's a very military company, as we learned from the sequel. Just throw it into that trouble spot and have it wipe out all those people. But then, of course, you've got to take care of the fact you have a lot of aliens now, because it's not just going to be one.
Yeah.
It's going to procreate big time.
I feel like ISIS would be easier to defeat than a country full of aliens.
Yeah, but I think that's maybe what they're aiming for.
Unless maybe they're fighting planets, and then you could just decimate an entire planet with this creature.
The end of the film originally was supposed to have this crazy moment where the alien rips off Ripley's head and then impersonates her voice. And that would have been surreal and kind of cool, but also a little too dark. And I guess Fox said, no, we just did Star Wars a few years ago. That was a monster hit. You have to end on some kind of positive note.
Well, it was supposed to end with her just getting away on the shuttle and no additional scene, and then Ridley Scott thought of that and pitched for an extra budget, and yeah, that's when he wanted it to end with her getting her head bitten off. I say, I don't think that would have been cool. I am so grateful that they didn't do that. Regardless of her surviving, like, I can see how it still would have been a cool movie if the alien had won in the end, but the alien talking in her voice, I think, would have been a bridge too far for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it didn't seem believable even just seeing the one movie, and of course in the sequels and prequels, the aliens don't speak at all.
No, they're pure hostility.
And they have the vocal cords that we can see, although I guess we don't have to see the vocal cords, but they don't seem to be able to speak in any kind of way. Even I guess they shriek, don't they?
Yeah, they do. But what would be the point of them speaking? They're just supposed to be these killing machines, right? Mm-hmm. And they're not stupid, but language seems like, I don't know, it would make them a whole different kind of antagonist. I like that they're just kind of these sleek, pure killing machines. It's a pretty sad ending for Ripley, we learn, when Aliens starts at the top of that. Mm-hmm. And we learn that she's a mother this whole time. This is what I'm talking about, where you don't learn their backstories whatsoever, whether Ridley Scott thought that Ripley was a mother or not when he was making this film. It is clear in Aliens, and it's refreshing to me that we don't learn that kind of stuff about these characters. We don't know what motivated them.
Another feminist movie we covered this year, we didn't mean to cover so many, but Kill Bill, there's a lot of similarities between these two characters, including the lack of sexualization of two otherwise very attractive women, Uma Thurman and Sigourney Weaver. Great athletes, too. That really helps the fact you believe in them even more, because they don't seem like they're just posing.
That's part of the reason, I guess, why Ripley keeps making all these lists of the greatest characters of all time. Certainly when you go into the greatest action heroes of all time, she always tops the list. I mean, not tops the list, but she's always in the conversation for sure.
Oh, you're reminding me of something I didn't do in the awards and list section, that she is one of the all-time heroes. I think she might be sixth, but they count that from Aliens rather than this one, so maybe that's why she wasn't on the list. But it's the same character, so I guess I should have put that in my little awards and list section.
I wonder why they picked Aliens and not Alien.
Well, she's a bona fide hero in that movie, and this is more of a survivor.
Okay, fair.
Well, the non-feminist antagonist in the whole film is Ian Holm, although we don't really know he's that much of an antagonist until almost the ending. He was in Lord of the Rings for us a long time ago, the last movie we ever covered in the Top 100 Project. And we also covered him in The Sweet Hereafter a couple years ago on the Canadian special. I think one of the great performances he's ever given. There's been four artificial persons, as Bishop likes to be called in the Alien, well, the first four at least. Ash, Bishop, Call, and David. A, B, C, D. Had to be a deliberate choice.
Oh, but the new one is Walter, isn't it?
Yeah, they're ruining that then, aren't they? And I say in the series, actually, because David is from Prometheus, so it's not actually chronologically in order. Yaphakoto is Parker. He was in Live and Let Die, the Bond film, and he was a method actor in this movie because he deliberately antagonized Sigourney Weaver, and they do have a lot of conflicts. And then even Balaji Badejo, he antagonized him because he wanted to hate the alien. Harry Dean Stanton, who dies second, always complaining in this film. We saw him briefly in The Heat of the Night and The Godfather Part 2. Don't forget he was the FBI guy, one of them at least. He was guarding Frankie Pantangeli, who took his own life. Veronica Cartwright's got three great thrillers in her resume. She's been in other films, but these are enough, really. This movie, The Birds, when she was a young girl, and then the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
She gives great fear.
And nobody listens to her. Like I said, she tries over and over again. They all listen to Mother, but they don't listen to Lambert. And the only other actors really in the movie are Balaji Badejo, his only film ever as the alien, and Helen Horton is the voice of Mother, which, as is pointed out online, I look for it this time, it's actually M-U-T-H-E-R. So that stands for something, but they just call her Mother in the way we think of M-O-T-H-E-R. Ridley Scott, we've covered him from Blade Runner because he had an AFI film. That was Blade Runner, the second list. We watched Thelma Louise, and we covered that last year?
I can't remember.
Yeah, last year, because it was 25th anniversary. And his most recent hit, of course, is The Martian. There's a lot of handheld camera work in this film, and Ridley Scott himself operated a lot of it, which is a Soderbergh touch, because Steven Soderbergh, for a long time now, has been operating, in addition to being the director, often the writer or producer, and the cinematographer. Ridley Scott uses silence as well as any sound effect in this movie. There's weird noises when Kane gives birth, if you will, to the alien. And there's also a faint heartbeat sound effect they use more than once in the more intense scenes. But very faint. Tons of movies have used that. Usually cheesy thrillers do. This one's not cheesy. And at least when they used the cheesy effect, they toned it down so you could barely hear it.
I know I'm always the hater of score, but I would like to point out how great this movie uses silence. That's how they build the tension with this perfect quiet and how effective that can be versus a score that's telling you what you should feel at every second.
And Jerry Goldsmith didn't even like the way they used his music.
Yeah, he said he wrote something completely different and hoped that they would be brave enough to use that, but then they were like, no, please just write a bunch of weird stuff instead, and which is what he did.
Ominous tones.
Mm-hmm.
We've covered some of his movies, Planet of the Apes, Patton, Chinatown, The Omen, LA Confidential. Some of those are AFI films, some of those are not, but he is maybe the greatest composer we've ever covered and maybe one of the greatest of all time. John Williams obviously is in that conversation, and Max Steiner and many others. So Ridley Scott, who's talked about how he did thousands of commercials before he ever came on the movie scene, he did The Duelist before this, but this was his second major movie. You just said you're not a fan of his, but just like Spielberg and his second movie was Jaws, what do you think of this as a sophomore effort?
Oh, I love Alien.
But I mean his work specifically, his direction.
Oh, he does an excellent job. All these little details we're talking about, whether it's the production design, the casting, the pacing, the slow burn, the special effects, the design of the alien, all these choices he made are choices that he made. He just is this highly competent director. Like, I'll never deny that he knows how to make a very good film. But he's just not my favorite. Usually he makes the types of films I'm not remotely interested in, but Alien is a great exception of a genre I'm not normally interested in, but it's just so well done that you can't resist it.
Two classics of the sci-fi genre he made in the span of only a few years, this and Blade Runner. The writers were Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett, who got credit for the story. O'Bannon clashed with production a lot. They're both on the long making of that's on the DVD, and I think it's on the Blu-ray as well, the making of special. And the movie was rewritten by a few different people. It's one of those things where they got the screenplay and said, this sucks, but we can work with it. And O'Bannon and Shusett maybe don't want to admit that. And maybe it isn't even true, but that's what I've heard in many places, that the screenplay isn't really their screenplay, the final version at least. They, or someone else, I don't know who it was, based the Nostromo and Narcissus, which is the escape shuttle in the movie, from Joseph Conrad books. And we talked about Joseph Conrad a few weeks ago when we did the documentary special about
Hearts of Darkness.
Heart of Darkness, exactly. Producers were Gordon Carroll, David Giler, and Walter Hill, and he's one of the unsung directors of the last, whatever it's been, 40 years or so, and after I listened to him on the Marc Maron podcast, where he was very good, I liked him a lot on that, I went back and watched 48 Hours, which is still funny and still fun after all these years, and a damn good thriller in its own right, too, different kind of thriller, a cop movie. It was thrown out there for him to direct this, but he didn't think he was right for it, but he's been a producer on, I think, all the movies. Now, maybe he and Giler and Carroll haven't been on set for all the movies, but they've at least been named producers on these things. And their guidance probably helped, because Scott was new. The writers apparently didn't write a very good script. It had to be adapted, at least. But they all work together, obviously, to make a pretty damn good movie. So it's 2-3-5-1. Ridley Scott always works in that ratio, or almost always anyway. It's a pretty doggone wonderful Blu-ray, I thought. Cinematographer was Derek Van Lint, who only shot 3 feature films. He died in Toronto in 2010. The editors were Terry Rawlings and Peter Weatherly. Rawlings cut Blade Runner for Scott a few years later, of course, and Chariots of Fire, which was also an Ian Holm picture. He was nominated for Supporting Actor for that, so Rawlings got a lot of Holm for a few years there. I like the dissolves on Hurt when they all wake up. He's in this position, then it's the camera over here, and then you see him in this position. And it's a nice, very slow way to build the movie, and not ominous. It could be read as ominous, but this whole thing where it's just this big, slow build. And like I say, he's the very first one to wake up. So it's all this setup that he's the one who's going to die first, but you don't know that then. You said Giger a few minutes ago. That's H.R. Giger. His genius designs, also working with Roger Christian and Carlo Rambaldi, who designed E.T. a few years after this movie. And Saul Bass worked on the opening titles uncredited. So those names behind the scenes, man, some huge people in there. The movie was nominated for the sets, but it didn't win that category. It did win for the visual effects, the only Oscar it did win. Okay, the influence. Like I said last week, listening to this podcast, that alone makes this an AFI-worthy movie. All the sequels and the prequels, the comics, the Alien vs. Predator spinoff that they've done for, what, 2, 3, whatever it is, movies? One of the greatest taglines in history. In space, no one can hear you scream.
Yeah, there's not a lot of competitors that could take on that for such great marketing.
And it's influenced, of course, by 2001 and Star Wars, and even Texas Chainsaw Massacre, according to Ridley Scott. And I mentioned the comparisons with Jaws and the lack of the monster, especially in the case of Jaws where it didn't work very well. This one's more a matter of, well, the less you see of him, the less he looks like a man in a suit, which is what he was in the end. The woman is a real hero. That was not a common trope back then. And she's not just a lucky survivor who's saved by a man. Well, she's a survivor, but she's not saved by anybody other than herself.
Yeah, she's a survivor because she is the smartest, most cunning, and most together one.
And I like that she's afraid in the end that you are my lucky star.
Yeah.
She's terrified, but she's got the balls to go through with this and
to win.
There's
this great stuff, if you notice, that when everybody's in the room with her, she always has her act together, and she never gets emotional, she never gets angry. And then the first time you see her get angry is when she's alone with the computer, and she starts yelling at the computer.
Mother!
Yeah, yeah, she kind of starts losing her cool there, but as soon as there's a witness, she's strong and together.
Last influence I have is that Weyland-Yutani, the evil company, they live on in the sequels. So they have not stopped being selfish and money-grubbing and very similar to modern companies in the real world.
So I have a couple more influences, movies that you could name, like The Abyss, Gravity, Life, that came up this year. Two other big things. Everyone's familiar with the Bechdel test. Well, in the original comic that the test is named for, Alien is the only movie that they can see because it passes the Bechdel test. Like, they're in a movie theater trying to choose, and that's the only one that passes it. And so, of course, it's not called the Bechdel test then. It's just the test of one of the characters arbitrarily made up. That it's just so fascinating because so few movies actually pass it.
We've covered a lot of them this year, though.
Yeah. I find it, like, a really interesting question to ask of a movie, too. And then the other influence is Save the Cat. And if you're a screenwriter, then you probably know the famous book, Save the Cat, Blake Snyder's famous screenwriting instructional. He uses saving the cat as shorthand for the moment a hero does something to permanently endear themselves to the audience. And he's specifically talking about Ripley, who's a hard ass throughout the film, but you just have to root for her once she saves Jonesy. No matter what she does in the rest of the film, because she saves the cat, you're like, she's my hero.
I get that. I don't disagree with it, but I think it's also bullshit. In that situation, the cat... fuck the cat.
But it's film. There's lots of bullshit in the film. That's the thing you can't get behind.
No. Well, yes. I can't get behind it. All right, so back to the awards and list section. We know it won the Oscar for visual effects. It's in the National Film Registry and was put in 2002, along with Boys in the Hood, which we covered, From Here to Eternity, and In the Heat of the Night. So those are AFI films, of course. The Alien itself was 14th on the top 50 villains. It's 7th in the sci-fi category of the top 100 genres. 2001, A Space Odyssey was number 1. Star Wars was number 2. Alien was 6th in the top 100 thrills. Psycho was number 1 in that one. And the movie was nominated for the top 25 music scores, but did not make it. Jerry Goldsmith was probably happy about that because he didn't like the way they used his score in the first place. Your final thoughts on Alien.
Well, you just listed all those AFI lists that Alien did make, and after revisiting it, I am renewed in my shock that they failed to honor it on either the top 100 lists when so many not as good movies made those lists. I can't be behind this movie more. I think it's one of the best action films ever made.
Should have been a slam dunk to make the AFI list, I would say. Maybe more than most other films we've covered in the last year and almost a half of the next 100 Project films. We've talked about some of them were worthy in that category and some weren't to have made the list we thought maybe should have. That wasn't the point of the next 100 Project. It wasn't about, oh, this should have made that list.
No.
But sometimes it was. Yeah. In this case, it definitely was overlooked.
Of the worst omissions, this is up there with Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're off next week to celebrate the English monarchy, for whom I have little respect. Victoria Day. When we check in with you again in 2 weeks, it will be Memorial Day in the United States of America. So let's do a war movie about the French fighting the Germans in World War I. Stanley Kubrick's Paths of Glory. The coming attraction trivia for Paths of Glory. And we had something like this one other time before, I think, but I couldn't think of anything else, so we'll go with this. How many actors headlined more than one Stanley Kubrick movie? We know he didn't use actors very often in any role, but certainly as his headliners in future films.
So for the answer to that question, please check out our next podcast for Paths of Glory. If you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free. And while you're there, please rate us and review us. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
In space, no one can hear you podcast. Unless they have really good earbuds.
And cut.